Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome. Not welcome back. Welcome to a brand new series. The first episode of exactly what I talked about last week. Hello, folks. If you missed last week's episode, this is the first of hopefully many interviews that I will be conducting with people in places about things incredibly vaguely. I want to get a greater understanding of the human experience, and I think there's no better way to do that than to directly go to people with unique stories that I personally don't have an experience with or know little about. So this is the first of that series. Luckily, I had one of my friends reach out to me saying that he would really like to tell his story on this podcast. So I thought this was a perfect way to feel, you know, to get to ease into the situation, to ease into this new series, because it's a friend. It's someone familiar with me. It's someone who will both be gracious with me and I will be gracious with him. So this first episode is particularly special to me because, you know, it's a beginning and it was a chance for me to be open and honest with a friend in a way that honestly, in a way that we haven't been before. And I feel really grateful that it happened. So this is that episode. This is that story. Definitely make sure to click the like button if you enjoy it. Definitely leave a comment down below about what you thought about it. I would love for this to start a bunch of conversations. And definitely be super gracious to both Harry and myself because the story is deeply personal and the story or the experience is, you know, one that is quite touchy. It's one that a lot of people don't talk about. But of course, sadly, it's one that happens far, far, far too much. In an ideal world, this would never occur, and this conversation wouldn't have to happen, but the sad reality is that it does. So a definite trigger warning to listeners and viewers, this conversation does depict acts of sexual abuse, sexual violence, sexual trauma, and we don't go into extremely graphic detail. We tend to talk more about Harry's greater growth from the experience, what he did to overcome the experience, what he's doing to overcome the experience. But, you know, we do talk about it in the beginning. So just a forewarning that that is a conversation that we have. But I do hope that you listen. I hope that you learn. And I hope that you enjoy our conversation. Oh, Mr. Harry, I'm so happy to have you on.
Thanks.
Tell everyone who you are, where you're coming from, your age, your pronouns, whatever you see fit.
Live from London, it's Harry Hitchens. My pronouns are he, him, and I'm a screenwriter and director. That's my kind of occupation, although I like to think I'm more than that at some point, but, you know, given my recent schedule, maybe that's not true.
It's January, it's not you. It's January. It's January 2022, that's what it is, more hyper-specifically.
Yeah. End of. Yeah.
It's an absolute mess. Do you feel like that there as well? I feel like nothing is happening in a strange way.
Yeah. I mean, it's not at the beginning of any year as a freelancer, it's always really dry. I mean, I remember years like getting my first call about a job in March. And before that, thinking like, oh, well, that's it then. You know, I've had my career. But it's all right. It's all right. It's not too bad. I mean, I'm nice and busy where I need to be. And I think after the last couple of years, I think having an easy start to the year or like a, you know, less frantic start to the year just helps you kind of sink into it and get used to the new months ahead, because even though I'm quite a cynical person, the new year does mean something to me, really. Like, I really want to make a fresh start of things, even if it goes to shit by March.
I 100% want to be the same person where I'm like, no, yeah, the new year doesn't define me, but I know it does in some strange way. I love the sort of flip of the calendar that feels like it is truly a fresh page, a fresh start. And I don't want to necessarily diminish myself into saying I want to be a new me. I always found that that's kind of strange behavior. Like, I like me. I want to change facets of me, but also it is a bit insufferable to hear people say, like, January 1st, brand new me.
Yeah, not going to happen, but it's a nice opportunity, isn't it? You know, it's an opportunity to say, what can I do better this year? I quite like this whole, this is why I kind of enjoyed the concept of this kind of show, was that you kind of saying to me that, you know, you're trying to be more curious, essentially, and learn more. And I think that's like a really, firstly, a really attainable aim, but also a really enriching one. It's not kind of something where, you know, I just want to lose 3 pounds or whatever, you know, but or kilograms, or whatever you guys use. But I think
don't reference our system. We're messed up. We are wrong. I think we officially need to admit it.
That's another show. But I think, it's a really nice thing to set a target for. I think is to be a bit more curious and learn a bit more, and you know, what can go wrong?
Definitely,
if that's your aim.
Definitely, and I mean. Yeah, I think that there's a level of listening to that a lot of people have learned to do over the last 2 years, and I kind of want to lean into that more this year than ever before, because I feel like I'm fortunate enough that I have access to so many stories in some way that it feels wrong to not hear them or to not allow people to even share them with the audience that I have. So you were one, if not the only person that like is a mutual of my own that responded to the story first. Like, no one else really responded necessarily. Not that I expected my friends to respond, but you were the only one. What does that say about you?
I don't know. Maybe that I'm potentially a narcissist, or maybe that I'm. I think what it
join the club
says. Yeah. What it more says is, I hope it says more than this, that. I think in many ways I was searching for an opportunity to kind of do this as well. And I think, you know, I spent a lot of my life either internalizing things that have happened to me in my life, or speaking about them in a way that isn't actually healthy, you know? And actually, as someone who makes documentaries and has made podcasts in the past, I've personally seen a real value in people having an opportunity to represent themselves in the way they want to represent themselves. So I think when I saw your Insta story, I was like, oh, this is something that could be interesting for me to do.
It's a very vulnerable topic for you to speak on, as well as honestly to listen to. I found myself in preparing for this, even though, again, we're friends, and we've known each other for years, to not even know how to approach a topic such as this. And honestly, for a lot of the responses that I got, to be like, how do I be a good listener? How do I be a good advocate, a good friend, a good interviewer, even though I don't really see this as an interview, I see it more as like a conversation. So it's one of those things that I think it's appropriate to admit upfront. And I think it's important to admit for a lot of people that, like, it is, there's no right way. There's definitely a few wrong ways, but it's difficult. Yeah. It's a hard topic to talk about.
And I think that is the kind of the main difficulty with, you know, trying to heal yourself as someone who's gone through any traumatic experience, but specifically experiences that I went through, because it's like a really difficult subject for people to broach, you know? And I've even had it with like therapists in the past, where trained professionals have found it difficult to talk about it and to kind of, without kind of going, oh, you're okay. And, oh, how awful was that? And admittedly, you know, sympathy is great, but pity is not, right? So actually speaking about it in like a declarative way is so freeing, because it becomes a topic and it becomes an event in your life rather than, kind of, I don't know, disabling trauma you know, which it can so easily be.
Yeah, I had this realization a year or two ago where I was letting a lot of my demons or my past kind of completely define me as a person, and it was beginning to kind of envelop and control me in a certain way. So I think when you allow yourself to take control of your narrative, and that doesn't demoralize it, it doesn't belittle it in any way, but to really define what you want it to be to the world, there's so much power in that. So I think, again, it's a very brave thing for you to tell, to talk about this so openly, and it's an under-discussed topic. So I think hopefully it does some good for other people if they're just here to learn, or if they've gone through something in and of themselves. But I would love, you know, as much as you're comfortable to tell a bit about it.
I was going to say, let's say what it is, because we've been very mysterious about it so far.
But isn't that isn't that kind of the problem? Is that people don't even know what the right word to say sometimes?
Yeah. There's so many words for it. I mean, I think the best way to kind of define what happened to me was just to say it quite clearly and without kind of trying to dress it up as anything it's not. Between the ages of about 7 and 10 years old, I was sexually abused by multiple perpetrators, and that's it, really. That's what happened. You know, there's lots of gruesome details. There's lots of horrible memories that I have that I don't really feel the need to go into. But that is essentially what happened. It's a part of my life that, undoubtedly the worst part of my life, the worst 3 years of my life at least. And the things that happen will stay with me forever. I'm constantly remembering and things are kind of coming up the more and more I go through like a healing journey, but that is what happened to me. And so over the last, like, I don't know, I'm 26 now. So, and I've kind of fully came to terms with it about when I was about 20, I think when I first came to terms with it. So it's been like 6 years of just kind of expressing it, trying to talk about it with therapist. I've even told my mum, you know, I've told my partners, that I've had over the years. And yeah, just a real journey of like building up to the point, in fact, where I'm able to say it right now in such a way.
No, definitely. Was there, did you, again, coming from a place of curiosity, did you know at the time, because, you know, when I think back to being a kid, 7 years old, 10 years old, you're just so blissfully ignorant to the world around you, and you don't even necessarily know that bad people exist or that harm is possible. Did you even quite realize that it was wrong, or that it was something bad was happening to you?
Yeah, I mean, it was, so at first, absolutely not, you know. I mean, there were clear signs eventually with the physical pain that experienced that this isn't a thing to do, you know, this isn't a good, okay thing. But, you know, as a kid and as a boy specifically, I don't think there was really any education that I experienced about this topic. You know, we didn't have the stranger danger classes. More importantly, like the person who abused me wasn't a stranger, right? And most importantly, around you, the stories that you're surrounded by in the media were all about girls, right, or women. So, as a boy, we're like way less likely to come forward if we've been abused in a way like that, because simply I think a lot of people just don't think this happens to boys, or that boys are quite, you know, we're quite masculine or hormonal, so we would have wanted it anyway. I mean, obviously no rational person would say a kid wanted that kind of thing to happen to them, but I think that's part of the problem as a boy or as a man. When something like that happens to you, if you haven't seen other people in the world like it, then you almost invent a narrative where it didn't happen, because it's so painful and so difficult to, you know, justify in your mind as something that happened. It's much easier to go, oh, well, that doesn't actually happen to boys, and it's not inappropriate if it happens to boys, so I'm going to, you know, save myself and forget that happened, which I did successfully for about 10 years. And then, you know, things came bubbling up.
Yeah. Did you end up internalizing it to a point where, not unlike it reminds me of like when I first realized I was gay, that I was like, oh, don't want to realize that anymore, I'm going to pretend it doesn't exist. And then inevitably, you know, when there's a truth about yourself or a truth to your history as a human, eventually it's going, you can't forget it, eventually it will come back. So did it sort of, when did it reemerge in your life, and I guess how did you How did you cope with it? Were you immediately in therapy, or was it?
Yeah, I mean, it's like it's a weird thing, isn't it? The realizing you're gay thing. It's actually very similar. I feel the same way. Where, I mean, I don't know about you, but when I came to terms with the fact, oh no, like, I really love dick. You know? when I came to terms with it like that, I was like, I realized, oh, for years I fancied boys, right? You know, and for years I've known about this, but somehow you feel completely able to walk through life unaware of the fact that you're going to have to come out.
Yeah.
And in a way it's like that when you have a traumatic memory, it's sometimes more cloaked in shame, and there's it's more complex, but ultimately it's the simultaneous feeling of feeling like you've forgotten something, but knowing you remembered it the entire time. Mm. And it's a really confusing feeling, and you can feel like you're inventing it almost in your head, because you think, no, this couldn't possibly have happened, because, you know, this person couldn't have done that, or, you know, it was so shameful, so wrong. So yeah, it took many years. And actually for me, I'm personally someone who came to terms with it pretty early. You know, men usually come to terms with it up to 20, 30 years after their female counterparts. And even, you know, female counterparts will come through usually. I mean, I'm speaking in binaries here, but you know, you get the stats are only in the binaries.
Yeah.
A woman might take 10, 15 years to come forward about child sex exploitation. Men, you know, 10 to 20 years on top of that.
If ever.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. So it's like something like 4% or something will ever tell anyone what happened to them. So yeah, I mean, it's years and years of not thinking about it. I think it all came, my first proper boyfriend. Did you ever meet Michael?
I believe so.
I think he did.
Yeah.
He was great. And
we have a lot of gay, friends. So we meet a lot of gay people a lot of queer people in general. So I'm like, yeah. Who have I met? Whose partner have I met?
How many dozen have you met from me? But I think Michael was he's my first like real proper boyfriend, and I loved him so much. And I felt able to confide in him. And that was my first step, really. And since then, you know, I've been able to tell my mum about it, which was a huge deal for me. And I went into therapy as well for about 4.5 years. And I'm actually thinking about going back soon. But so it's been a real kind of tricky road. And there have been some really, really dark moments as well. Some moments where I couldn't handle all the memories that were coming back to me. And still, I'm sure in the future, there'll be periods of time where I find that really difficult. But I feel like I'm in a pretty good place right now, because I'm here, aren't I? I'm having a conversation with you about it, and I'm able to single-handedly remember what happened and not be so bothered. Because I think when something happens in your life like that, the worst train of thought you can get yourself into is thinking, I'm never going to be okay with this. How could I possibly be okay with remembering something that's so horrific? How can I ever cross my mind, even if it hadn't happened to me, and that not bother me? But I think, you know, I've proved that kind of train of thought wrong.
No sense. It's an incredibly courageous act to confront it and to talk about it openly, especially when it's, you know, it's such an injustice to you that happened, and there's nothing that you did wrong. And I feel like that must be kind of complicated to grapple with. I feel like that is something that a lot of people say, is like, I feel like I could have, you know, not put myself in that situation, all that, you know. And that's a natural, I think, feeling to have of like, if there was any way to undo it, I would. But, you know, the truth of the matter is that when people are victimized in that way, it's absolutely not their fault. They didn't do anything. It's the person who committed the act that is completely at fault.
I think it's really difficult to come to terms with that. But yeah, you're right.
And it's like, it must be a total emotional roller coaster. Even after talking about it, it doesn't simply just go away, or it doesn't simply just get better. I'm sure too, did you have people that like didn't even understand it, or didn't approach it in the way you had hoped they would, I guess, with as much empathy, maybe even?
Yeah, it's really hard for people to hear this. It's a combination. You don't know whether they've been through something similar, so they might not really want to talk about it. So if you're a survivor of sexual assault or exploitation, If you talk to someone about it and they're kind of quite standoffish, there could be a chance they've gone through it. So, you know, don't pass judgment too soon. But also, yeah, I mean, it's really hard. Can I swear? I've been swearing.
Of course.
I haven't asked.
Course you can.
Okay. Fuck yes, say. Okay. No, but I think, I mean, people don't, I mean, it's really hard to talk about, you know, it's a horrible thing. It's a really horrible, it's like it's the ultimate thing. If you talk about most hated people in the world, it's basically paedophiles, isn't it? I mean, you can't really get much more hated than that. I think even murderers are kind of, you know, like you're better off being a murderer than you are a paedophile in society, if you can really do that, if you can choose. But I think, I think that kind of instant prejudice is always in people's minds. It's not against you as a victim of it, but it's against that kind of, the act is so repulsive to people that it's really hard for someone to talk about.
I just think too that people probably just don't want to believe that that could exist. It's like it's such a level of evil that most people can't even wrap their minds around, that admitting that it exists, and if someone's telling you personally, admitting that it exists that close to you as well, is quite terrifying for anybody, whether you have a child yourself or you're just a human navigating the world, to be like, oh, bad things can happen to me anytime. I should be afraid. It's not a fun way to navigate the world.
Yeah, it's the same reason you don't look at your news app some days, because you just don't want to know what else has gone wrong.
I refuse to download those apps that say, like, what are the neighborhood watch apps or whatever. Yeah. I refuse. Yeah. I don't want to know.
In London, it's like, it's hilarious. They have an app called Next Door, I think it is.
It's the one we have to.
And it's just like, oh yeah, I saw a man with a machete on St. Peter's Close. I'm like, oh, thanks for letting me know. You know, London's pretty rogue right now, actually.
Yeah.
It's pretty rogue.
It's here, here as well. It's just
robbery. The idea of having a news app on my phone where it like goes ding, 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 ding. It's like headline, fuck, okay, what else has happened now? You know,
another gripe I have is who allowed push notifications for important news topics to go to our phones, and how do I turn it off? Because I don't need to know.
sadistic app inventors.
Not fair.
Did that. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I think it's a really difficult one, because you're, as a survivor or as someone who's gone through something really scary and horrible, because it applies to any kind of traumatic event in a way, your worst nightmare is being a burden as well. So when someone can't handle it, that's kind of like confirming all of your beliefs, you know, potentially incorrect beliefs, that you are a burden to people around you, which you most likely aren't, you know. But people just don't have the vocabulary sometimes to help.
Yeah, and it is a very difficult one. When, you know, being a man and a gay man as well, how does something like this, you know, I'm sure there's a level of identity crisis that occurs, but especially when, you know, your sexual identity or your gender identity is involved as well, did that make that quite complicated, or was it not as complicated?
Yeah, it's really difficult. I mean, you know what it's like when you're at school and you start having that kind of sexual awakening. It was firstly already scary, because I'm like, oh no, I might be like, you know, a gay.
Oh no.
Is he, you know, that's like scary enough, right? And then there's the really kind of like dark, scary complication when you've been sexualized early in an abusive context by men, to then have a gay awakening is like, it's the most sickening thing you can think of, because I didn't realize this didn't come to me early on, really, because I think I was just so hellbent on forgetting it happened. But I would say even well into my like late teens and early 20s, when I was actually like doing work in like the LGBT activism space, I was thinking, oh God, like, is this why I'm gay? You know, is this thing that happened to me, has it caused this? You know,
I think that's a natural thought, to be honest. Yeah. I would definitely, the amount of thoughts I had as someone who didn't go through that as a gay kid, still had a thought of like, is there a reason? Is there something that turned me gay? Because again, the media tells you that. Told you more so.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, it still does in Britain anyway. But I mean, I think I've come to the conclusion that, you know, at first I was like, no, it's not that, you know, it's just that I'm a chemical thing or I don't know what it was. But ultimately I've come to the conclusion now where I'm like, okay, well, so I was abused as a kid. Does this make me gay? Well, I don't know if there's any way of knowing that, firstly. And secondly, I'm so at peace with it now that I would say that it doesn't matter. Like, even if someone proved to me, okay, everything that happened to you as a kid's made you, you know, a fabulous homosexual, because that's how they would obviously, that's how the scientists would deliver the news. Yeah. Then I would say, well, I would say, like, who cares? You know, like, I'm gay, and that's basically it. You know, it doesn't matter how I got here, whether it was, you know, what happened to me or just playing too much Gaga. Like, it doesn't really make a difference. You know, I am here and I'm gay, and I'm very fortunate enough to live in a country and surrounded by people who accept me. So that's the end of it, you know.
I'm a bit stuck on if doctors delivered bad news or just news in general in terms of fabulous. You are a fabulous homosexual. You have tremendous cancer. We found a lump. Like, oh my god. Oh my god, you'll never guess.
Honestly, like, we have a nice national health service in this country, but I'd go private if that doctor was available.
Can't relate, by the way. wait, you get health care?
What? I'm a Brit. That's the only benefit for living in this godforsaken island. But yeah, I mean, yeah, I think it doesn't matter, basically. And the feeling is all, it always comes back with all these things. You know, right now I'm sitting here going, yeah, I'm great. You know, I've come so far, and I have, you know, really have. But you know that I can get low sometimes still, and that can happen at any moment. But, you know, you've got to celebrate the wins. And one of those wins is recognizing that my identity is my identity, whether, you know, regardless of how it happened or how it came to be like this.
Yeah. And when you're in those lows, is it kind of that of, like, when I'm in my depressive lows, it's almost, I've come to understand it so much that I know that in a weird way, nothing anyone can say to me will help. You know, all the givens of, like, I just want to connect with someone, but even when they connect with me, I hate them for it.
Yeah.
Like, how dare you text me back? Leave me alone, even though I texted them.
Yeah. No one can get it right, you know.
Yeah, you almost have to let the storm pass in some strange way, and then you can be totally fine and normal.
It gets boring, though, right? It's boring, when you're the one being depressed. Yeah.
It is exhausting.
Now, not again.
Yeah, I find myself more and more fed up with it. Like, I'm so annoyed that I'm here in this moment. And I know, and I also know myself well enough to be like, there's no way, there's no cure to get out of it. I have to weather the storm, which is stupid and horrible. It's like when someone says, give it time, dear, give it time.
So fuck you, give me some, like, medication or, like, some quick kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know? It's 2022.
Fix my brain, please. I don't want to deal with this. It's heavy.
Just like, I'm afraid you've got fabulous depression.
Oh my god!
There's nothing we can do about it.
This is dark. I've never saw this. When I got, like, officially diagnosed with depression back years and years ago, I think as one does, especially as, like, the internet humor has evolved, the person who was officially diagnosing me said something, was asking questions in such a serious way that I didn't know how to answer them in a serious way. So it was like, how often do you drink, and do you drink to cope? And I'm like, I drink all the time. And she's like, that's not a funny answer. And I'm like, okay. And she'd be like, how do you feel, like, on an average day? I'm like, absolutely horrible. She was, like, looking at me with, like, not flinching.
Yeah.
And it was painful. There was no, it was tomato, you know, I was the jester.
That's the difference between American and UK health systems, because today I was having, like, an initial consultation with a new therapist. I'm kind of doing a few interviews with some therapists at the moment to make sure I like them before I jump in, because I've been there and it's, you know, not good when you're 5 weeks in wondering how you're going to break up with your therapist more than you are your trauma. But today the guy said, I'll just need a questionnaire. And he said, how much you drink? And I was like, well, I think the last time I had a drink was last week, actually, it was probably over a week ago. And he just looked at me like I was like a real loser. He was like, oh, okay. You know, and it's like, is that the difference? This British thing is like, oh, really? Okay, cool. Nice one. Yeah. You don't have liver cancer, you know. Yeah.
You didn't have a pint for lunch.
Yeah, what's going on?
Wimp.
You're not doing this from the pub. Like, he just turns his laptop around and he's at the bar.
It is shocking. The British culture of that. I remember the first few times I came over and I became friends with you and all the others, where it's just like, well, you just meet for a pint. Like, it's 1 o'clock on a Tuesday.
Yeah, but it's a beautiful. They have a fire, so.
Yeah, we're classy in America. We get drunk in our basements alone. Thank you. Yeah. Not in daylight.
No, God forbid.
Shifting gears a little bit, you know, you're a filmmaker yourself, and I really do think that, in a way, art can really shift the world and shift perspectives in almost unspeakable ways. Do you think that the stigma against survivors and victims of sexual assault, as well as, and even more mainly, I guess, of male victims, do you think that's been caused from the depiction in movies and television shows and how it's been just spoken about, frankly, in the media, or lack thereof?
Yeah, I think it's totally to do with that. I think it's also down to, I think it's potentially due to homophobia as well. Or the denial of like homosexual identity, because of the perpetrators mainly being men. In I mean, 10% of perpetrators, or maybe over 10% of perpetrators, are women. So women do commit these crimes, especially against younger children. The younger the child is, the less kind of difference there is between the victim's gender and the perpetrator's gender. But mostly they're men, right? And I think sexism and homophobia comes into play, where you imagine that if the perpetrator's a man, it's got to be, you know, a woman who's on the other end of that abuse, either because you're exhibiting sexism where you say, oh, only a woman could succumb to the abuse, or you're homophobic, saying, oh, well, a man wouldn't be into a boy or whatever, you know. So when actually we've seen throughout history that male survivors exist, even from, I mean, I know there's always that kind of huge stereotype that like ancient Greece and was this perfect gay place, when it really wasn't. You know, that what really happened in ancient Greece and ancient Roman times was that older noble men would have 12, 13 year old poverty stricken boys, and those boys would be in the baths and they would be their kind of equivalent of a mistress. They wouldn't be paid. They would essentially be raped in these bars. And that was the extent of homosexual culture, right, back then.
That and the misinterpretation of it in the Christian Bible. It was replaced, for everyone that doesn't know. It was originally meant to say, like, men don't sleep with younger men. And people misinterpreted it into saying it just meant men don't sleep with men, not men don't sleep with children, aka pedophilia versus homosexuality, which then began the weird intertwining of two things that don't go together at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly. And then it became, even in Eastern Europe, the word for paedophile is the same word as homosexual. So they're all conflated ideas that can get confused with translations or passings down, or people kind of wanting to invent their own versions of what history was like. But, you know, it's a long-winded way of saying that, like, it's always been here, but I think as a culture, we haven't been really very ready to accept it. And it is just down to our own prejudices, essentially. And I think the world would be, you know, a lot easier place for people like me if they could understand that boys and men, this happens to them.
Well, in a weird way, too, I think that society, I don't even know really how to word this, but I think society doesn't want to believe that men couldn't want a sexual experience, like, in a strange way, in a different way than how we sexualize women usually. And in a weird way, we sexualize men to the point where it says there's no way a man couldn't want a sexual advance. So there's no way a man could be uncomfortable with someone hitting on them, someone touching anything. There's no possible way. It doesn't exist. All men think about and all men want is sex, which
so true,
which obviously isn't true, but coming from personal experience is absolutely not true. Don't touch me. Yeah. Don't look at me. Don't talk to me.
Yeah. And I know that, you know, with your various difficulties. Connor's for everyone that doesn't know, Connor is, a beautiful person, but consistently says that he cannot fall in love with anyone because, you know, he's not beautiful or perfect enough.
Listen, I'm terrified of them. That. I don't believe that. Nope, get away from me.
This isn't, you know, we don't want to go too dark. We don't want to make this a therapy session for you, Connor. But
No. You know, the internet's heard enough of that over the last decade.
your Twitter followers already know this.
Which book do you want to read? Book one, book two, or book three? They've been written on it.
But yeah, I mean, I think what was I talking about? I can't remember.
Men being sexualized.
Yeah, the point you made was such a good point in that boys always want sex. Vis-a-vis a licorice pizza, which I won't go on about too much.
I do think that that's interesting. Go on if you want.
Licorice pizza, for people don't know, it's a recent movie by probably my favorite filmmaker, Paul Thomas Anderson. He's made incredible movies over the years and you should watch all of them. But Licorice Pizza was this film about a 15-year-old boy and a 25-year-old girl, and her picking him up pretty much from his school while she was working there, and then developing this kind of romantic relationship. When he actually eventually found a girl that was his age, she manipulated him into coming back. I mean, it was a really like crazy film, but it's got 5 stars everywhere. And the reason for that is people are like, well, you know, he's 16 when he kissed her. Yeah, he was 15 when he was being essentially groomed. Some reviewers at like top magazines have even like said, oh, well, maybe she wasn't 25. Maybe she was lying. Maybe she was kind of late teens. I'm like, the filmmaker said in interviews that she is 25.
I think they say it in the film. It's like the opening line.
One of her main lines that she keeps coming back to throughout the film is like, should I be hanging out with these 15-year-olds? I'm like, no, bitch, no, you fucking shouldn't. And I think like if the roles were reversed there, the genders were reversed, if this was a 25-year-old dude and a 15-year-old girl, then it just wouldn't be made. I mean, it would have been made 20 years ago, but like it just would not get made now. So it really pissed me. I feel really let down by Paul, but.
I know I had mixed feelings because obviously I know that even watching the movie, I enjoyed the movie, and obviously the whole time being aware that like this is wrong, this relationship is wrong, and it's this difficult thing with being like, I don't want cinema to always be politically correct because it was a depiction of, I don't even remember, the 70s, the 60s, which, you know.
Yeah, 70s, yeah.
Yeah, and like things like this happened then, but my issue with it was it didn't, we won't spoil it, but the ending in a way like confirms that it was okay and it just wasn't necessary to the plot, and it was a choice. That's all I'm gonna say. It was a choice to make that the ending. It's weird.
The any interview with him with the filmmaker essentially says that we're supposed to fight for this couple to be together. That's what we're supposed to fight for. I'm just like, what? And he in the interview kind of harks back saying, oh, you know, it was a time where kids could be truly independent and, you know, they weren't tracked on their phones by their parents and they could go out and be free. And I was like, yeah, that's really great. But if you're romanticizing and harking back to a time where, oh, you could be free to have an inappropriate and potentially abusive relationship, that's not something I would especially, you know, want to remember fondly. And actually, he does a very good job of criticizing other parts of the 70s. But I won't speak any more on it because I get too angry about this because he's my favorite filmmaker and he's like my film daddy. So
totally. And like, things like that are a difficult topic because, again, art from the artist, all these conversations, but it does make me wonder, if that was someone's first movie they saw of his, or if like a really young impressionable mind saw that, does that, if they don't catch the reference that the relationship is wrong, or if the relationship isn't implied to be wrong or what have you, or if all the reviews say such a thing, then for all intents and purposes, it's right in their mind. Yeah. And as a young boy, that means you think, oh, it's okay if I have a relationship with my teacher. and yeah. and wrong, you know, some things that are wrong in that way that continue to push this narrative in society that men can't be abused and men can't be taken advantage of. And with anything, it perpetuates this like boys club culture of good for you, you slept with someone when you were 13 that was 23, that's amazing, which it's not. I don't know why that's even a thought in someone's head.
Yeah, and I mean, even that, but even worse, what if like a 15-year-old kid or maybe an 18-year-old person is sitting there watching it and going, oh crap, like that person who I felt manipulated by when I was 15 didn't manipulate me, actually it was all me, I wanted it, you know. It's just so bad.
It's messy. It's very, very messy.
Fuck you, Paul. Do you think Phantom Thread is still one of the best films ever, but like fuck you, know.
It's so good. And yeah. it's really, really good. What so you know, you taking that, because in a weird way it could be a full circle moment for you, because you are working in film, and I know that you are working with topics such as this. So do you see in a weird way that you want to be, if no one else is depicting it accurately or if no one else is starting the conversation, you do yourself, you almost want to like take control of it?
Yeah, I mean, I just actually just came off a long phone call with my exec producer who's making this film with me right now. We were talking about how like it's quite an easy sell for her because there literally isn't a story about it ever that's ever been made. So it's quite a kind of opportunity, as it were. But I also think for me, writing this film about it's kind of semi autobiographical, right? I mean, it goes to very, very extreme places that I haven't gone to. It's kind of a revenge film, essentially. So it's kind of like all my fantasies drawn out into a
promising young woman style.
Yeah, bitch. brilliant film. So I think, I can't wait to not be doing it in a way. I mean, I'm really excited to make the film and I think it's going to be great. And I think, I really hope that other people like me can watch it and go, that's me on the screen. And I feel heard by this and I feel, represented. I'm looking forward to making something that isn't about the darkest period of my entire life. I think that's kind of, it's a double-edged sword, making art about your trauma. It can feel like you're not an artist. Actually, it can feel like you're just someone who had something horrible happen to them, and this is your way of coping with it. So, in a really unhealthy, probably silly way, I'll feel like a real filmmaker when I make something that isn't about this, you know. But for now, I'll just be kind of like a pseudo one that's kind of a survivor who's making a film rather than like a filmmaker who's making a movie. So, yeah. But I am really excited by it, and I've always made art that's quite personal to me. I've just found that easy to access, I guess, and also very beneficial and, you know, sometimes very good fun as well.
Yeah, no, I feel similar too. It's almost, you find yourself a little bit insufferable when you continue to talk about the same thing over and over, or you say, I feel like I've not gotten over this necessarily, but I feel like I understand it enough where I'm exhausted by the fact that I need to continue to make it a part of my story or to like relive it in a strange way within my art and within the themes of my art. So I feel so validated in you saying, I can't wait until I make something about something else.
Yeah. Yeah. That feels like I mean, even though it's wrong, even if you said that to me, you know, I still see you as an author, whether your book's about whatever your book's about, you know,
whatever. So
yeah, whatever your book's about, even if it was about little bugs.
Pig farming? You
know? Depends what kind of pig you're talking about.
A cute little one.
rather than like a little, yeah, okay. I'm going to go into like grinder tribes in a minute. I think it's like, you know, you've got to kind of look at yourself and go, fuck you, you're obviously an artist, you know, you're obviously doing things, and say that to yourself and make sure you remember it. But yeah, I'm currently writing like the next film right now, and I just can't wait to, it's so far from anything that happened to me, which is really nice, you know.
Yeah.
And that's going to be fun. But I think it's ultimately, I feel more than anything, it's like the ultimate privilege to be able to make something like that. There's that therapeutic and that helpful. And it doesn't take making a feature film to to do that, by the way. You know, you don't have to make a whole movie, but I think even just writing and getting some stories out and in whatever format, I think it's really freeing. It's really nice to do.
It really is. Even if it doesn't go anywhere, I think even though you may think you understand something that's traumatic about your past, there are definitely little nuances and little crevices that you haven't explored. So really allowing yourself to, even if it's just in a journal or something very personal that never sees the light of day, I think you'll understand yourself and your truth much greater if you do allow yourself to inevitably go there. That could be a journal, that could be therapy, it could be whatever you want. How do you have any advice for anyone else who's struggling with this? Or even on the flip side, how do you wish that like people would have these conversations, or how do you have these conversations with your friends or your family?
I was going to say in this, I guess, advice, in the advice section of that question kind of fits into, when you're talking about writing and journal entries and stuff, I have to say, even if you've never written a script before, writing a conversation really helps me. And the film began because of something my mum said. My mum's a really funny person. She does not mean to be a funny person, but she's kind of a classic ditzy kind of mum. I don't mean ditzy unkindly. I mean, she just is. And to give you an example, actually, before I give the piece of advice, we were watching Don't Look Up recently, you know, the new Netflix film. It's got Leonardo DiCaprio in it. And there's this bit towards the end of the film, I won't spoil it, but Leo's not having a good time, right? Yeah. He's in a bit of danger at the end of the film. And my mum, right, without a hint of irony, completely sincerely, just said, "Oh, poor Leo. First Titanic and now this."
Rose!
Right? So she's fucking great, right? So she's a perfect person to start. And I had this conversation with her when I kind of came to terms with what happened to me, and I'd been through a bit of therapy. I thought, I need to tell my mom about what happened to me as a kid. And we had the best conversation. It was such an amazing and heartbreaking, but also amazing conversation. And she did come out with something quite funny, and I won't mention it on this podcast, but she said something really funny. And I thought, that's a really great, I couldn't help myself, that's a really great bit for a script, right? You know the feeling, I'm going to use that. Mm-hmm. And one of the most interesting exercises for me to do, and I would say for anyone else to do, is to write out that conversation. For me, it really was amazing to write a script and to write something like that, because what you're doing in a script is you have to become this other character. You have to put yourself in the shoes of how this person would feel. So sitting down to write the scene where the lead character in this film tells his mother what happened to him, I mean, it was a really tough scene. It took me a long time to get through, but to really understand what it felt like for her to have to hear that her son went through that, it was just life changing. That, and I would say, if something really horrible has happened to you, or even if you know something, maybe not even something that dramatic has happened to you, writing it out in a script format, it doesn't need to be professional, but in any document, writing a conversation automatically allows you to see it from more than one point of view. And if you're able to see it from more than one point of view, you gain perspective, and the problem doesn't become smaller, it just becomes something that you feel stronger to manage. So good for me to do that.
Yeah, that sounds really lovely. Yeah, typical. My parents are a similar type of way. They say things that are both incredibly hilarious but incredibly prolific without even realizing it at the same time.
Yeah. I wish I wrote all of the things down, but yeah.
Just record all conversations at all times.
At all times, yeah.
We do a thing for my dad for Father's Day every year where we basically, it's like a roast every single year where we make fun of all the funny things, because we're constantly writing down the funny things that he says all year round, and we roast him on Father's Day. And for some reason, it's become a tradition, even though it's quite evil, but he loves it, where he's like, I am ridiculous. I am hilarious.
Yeah. I'd love that too. But from, again, a pure narcissism point of view, it's like, oh, people are writing about me. Great.
Exactly.
Main character vibes.
Yes, exactly. That's how we all need to see ourselves, though. It's the only way we get through it. Mm-hmm. Well, sure. Thank you for the lovely conversation. I do hope this gives people insight into, you know, something they may have never been able to talk about or may have never really heard spoken about either. It's kind of the whole idea with the series or with whatever you want to call it, is just getting a little bit of insight into someone else's life and someone else's story and learning to empathize with something that you yourself may never go through.
Yeah.
So thank you. Thanks for being here.
Oh, no, thank you. I think it's such like a nice experience to be able to just talk about it in this way. And I also think like it's going to be good to listen to, you know, whoever you have on in the future, because I think allowing people that space is an honor for both of you in a way. You know, for the interviewer to be, you know, able to hear this story, but also for the person who's speaking to, like, you know, I feel like this story is important to another person other than me. And I know I've joked about narcissism, but I promise you that's not what it is.
I promise you, I'm not a narcissist. Classic narcissist.
Yeah, thanks very much.
No worries. And that's it. Thank you, thank you, thank you for listening to episode number one, the first of hopefully many. If you are listening, be sure to rate us 5 stars anywhere podcasts are listened to. If you're watching, click the like button, subscribe down below, leave a comment, and join the conversation. I would really appreciate that. And speaking of appreciation, thank you to Harry for being so open and so vulnerable with his story. You know, I really feel fortunate that he felt comfortable enough to talk with me and talk with, you know, seemingly the world about such a hardship, such a struggle. So yeah, I'm deeply grateful for that. So definitely show some love for Harry down below. I'll leave all his info in the description. But that's all I got for you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. Thank you for having an open mind and an open heart in this conversation. I know I stumbled through my words at certain points of it, but I tried my best, and I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you so much. Have a good one, everyone, and I will talk to you later.